You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode number 71 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton,
and I'm Tristan Carcino,
and we are coming to you from Renton, Washington. Or are we?
Yeah, we're still in Renton, Washington.
So we are at your new house that we spent all day moving into, the fabulous Pelton Brothers moving team with assistance from our cousin Katie and her husband Ben has moved you into your new home.
It was just like one long podcast. I moved.
You couldn't unsubscribe from this one.
I moved from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks, to Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
You're technically in unincorporated King County now, but it is a Renton address.
Oh, and it feels good to be back in the un-ink.
Yeah. Now both of us are rocking unincorporated King County. Shout out to not having the city. Should we start here by talking about what you're drinking?
I'm drinking a cool frosty Rainier Tallboy.
Of course you are. To celebrate. Well, first off, let's toast to the new house. And then let's talk about how hopefully tonight you're going to be drinking Rainier Tallboys right there with us.
Tonight, when you listen to this, we will be at...
Well, unless you listen to this after Tuesday, in which case the show has already happened. Hopefully it was great.
You missed out. Oh, there were antics. It was crazy. But our first ever live show...
Possibly our last. Possibly our only. Can't rule that out.
It'll be our last ever by popular demand. We will be having the first ever live Peltoncast with special guest Danny Kelly from TheRinger.com. We will be crowning, at this moment, the winner of our search for Seattle's Better. It's dicks on one side, you need a burger on the other, in an upset, we are going to find out which is better. Right now, I have no idea what I'm going to vote for.
I feel like dicks is like that classic traditional program, maybe has been a little off in recent years, has not gotten the same hype as some of the up-and-coming programs like UNITA. But when it counted, Dicks came through with an incredible...
They've got experience.
They've got the pedigree, the coaching, all of that.
And most importantly, we hope you're there drinking Rainier Tallboys with us, having a good time. We'll be hanging out after.
Wait, did we say where it was?
It's at Vermilion on Capitol Hill.
Wait, can you pick a place that we can go after the show so we can tell people to go there if they can't make it to the show? I'm putting you on the spot here.
I just don't know.
All right, well... Check out Peltoncast on Twitter. Obviously, we'll announce it at the live show, assuming you have decided on a location by that time. I have a to-do list for the live show, and one of the things is Tristan
is pick a location. I don't know where to go. Should we go to the comment? Let's go to the comment. Let's say we're going to the comment. How does that feel?
There we go. That's perfect.
Okay.
So if you can't make it to the live show at 7 p.m., I'm guessing somewhere around 9 o'clock, we'll probably be heading to the comment to have a drink or perhaps even two. We'll see how the night treats you. It is a work night, but stay as long as you can. Anything else people should know about the live show?
So there were free tickets. They're sold out. They sold out almost instantly.
Let's not exaggerate here.
Within the first 150 hours of being on sale.
Okay, that's probably checks out.
But if you didn't get one of those free tickets, you should still come on down. They're standing room only. There will be no shows. I know of at least three already people who have reserved tickets and have told us that they're not coming.
They were like, no, I can't possibly come to this.
You know what? There will be a lot more. If I know one thing, it's good. There's going to be a lot of people, aren't there?
You know a little something about ticketing. Anyways, we expect that it'll be a great time. The show probably won't be great, but you get a chance to meet the other listener and just hang out, and the Rainier will be cold.
And happy anniversary to a loyal listener, third Pelton brother, Damon, who will not be joining us.
Yeah, reason.
His wife did not want to celebrate her anniversary at the Fabulous Pelton Cast Live.
All right, well, before we spend too much time talking about future live Pelton Cast, let's focus on this current Pelton Cast.
Okay.
Where later on we will be joined by special third Pelton brother, the most appropriate third Pelton brother to help us preview week one of the Seahawks season, as well as recap the Husky opener.
Bill Barnwell. Oh, not Bill Barnwell. Okay.
It's a BB.
Okay.
It's not him. No. So stay tuned for that.
Wow. I am looking forward to that.
Let's start with a little of the weekly roundup. And maybe start with, there's no real news on the arena front. Might have some things start rumbling later in the week, because next Tuesday, September 12th, is when the mayor's office is scheduled to deliver a final memorandum of understanding with Oakview Group for the redevelopment of Key Arena to the city council, who will then subsequently be voting on it in all likelihood in December. But the only arena in real news of the last week is something that actually technically has nothing to do with the arena. So I don't know if you saw this, listener, but the Seattle Times announced last week that its writers will no longer be allowed on KJR. And here's their statement. "We have implemented minor changes to our freelancing and competing media code of ethics. It has been erroneously reported that we have instituted a ban on all media. That is inaccurate."
Accent added.
Yeah, that was my tone. Also, I'll also go ahead. This does mean that Seattle Times writers are still free to come on the podcast.
If we'll have them.
"We have made a corporate decision to not allow any appearances on KJR AM 950. We are not comfortable associating our brand with some of the off-color sexist commentary on that station. We will evaluate appearances of our journalists on a case-by-case basis based on the best interests of the Seattle Times Company." Quote, Executive Vice President Alan Fisco got credited for that one. So the comments on this.
He was the person who was high enough up who was willing. He got the short end of the stick.
The comments on this suggest that perhaps this decision was not in the best interests of the Seattle Times Company, because even though their stated reason was the off-color sexist commentary on KJR, many people thought that there might be a relationship with the fact that the Seattle Times editorial staff has tended to favor the Key Arena location and oppose a Soto Arena. And KJR, conversely, has largely been proponents of the Soto Arena and perhaps critical of some of the reporting of the Seattle Times on the arena situation. And, you know, your mileage may vary on how to read into that.
I mean, this is such a strange story, right? This kind of came out of nowhere. And it's something that, to me, if we're going to jump to this conclusion, right?
No, we're not drawing any conclusions.
Okay. But were we to jump to that conclusion, it would be a very strange decision by Seattle Times to pull their writers and to basically reduce the extension of their brand, right? Because those people are out there promoting themselves, and people are subscribing to the Seattle Times because they want to read those individual writers.
Yeah, for sure.
And now, general people have less access to hear those voices and to say to themselves, I want to hear more about what this person has to say, right?
Which I feel bad for the reporters at the Seattle Times. This was not their decision. Now, if we talk about the reason that the Seattle Times did give, I mean, I think it would be hard to defend all of the KJR history.
There was a bracket of women.
Yeah, the Bigger Dance, which ended a few years ago. It has been pointed out by many people that the Seattle Times accepted advertising for the Bigger Dance.
No issues at all for these. How many years did they do it?
And it was probably over 2 decades.
Recently got uncomfortable with sexism.
I know. I was definitely in high school at the very latest when the Bigger Dance started. So, yeah, and their Seattle Times reporters continued to go on the station throughout that. So it seems odd that if that's the reason that anything that has happened recently would actually cause you to change that position.
But to make this decision because of your stance of where an arena should be, if that would be the case that they were to be doing this, is a shocking decision to me. I just don't get it.
I mean, if that were the case, it would continue to suggest how much the battle lines have been drawn in this city over the arena project.
I mean, let's just say
fans overwhelmingly on the Soto side of things.
They're weighing the money that is going to be lost because of subscriptions. Who knows what it was? It was non-zero, though, right? There were people who canceled
according
their subscriptions.
To the comments, people said they canceled their subscriptions, yes.
Let's say maybe there was money coming in on the other side, and they're weighing these two things and saying one is greater than the other.
Well, we know that the Seattle Times approached the Port of Seattle about advertising over the past year and mentioned, you know, commiserated about the arena and some of that communication from like Frank Blethen, the managing owner of the Seattle Times. So,
what was the dollar amount on there?
I don't know if there was a specific dollar amount on that one.
Okay, I thought there was.
Not sure on that, but that will be one to you know, continue following us. I don't know if there's anything more to come on that, but
Seattle sports media, the two pillars of Seattle sports media, disentangling themselves from each other.
I'm sorry, there was.
I thought there was
a dollar figure on that. 290,000 in promotions from the Port of Seattle,
which probably outweighs the amount that those subscriptions that were canceled because of this cost.
Yes, and Frank Buthen, the publisher and CEO of the Seattle Times. Let's see, here was his comment.
He was willing to put his name on that one.
Yes, he was willing. it was the reply from Ted Fick, the CEO of the Port of Seattle, who said, "Thanks for the proposal. We've been focused on the street vacation matter, which we all must agree was effort worthwhile." All must agree. All. All right. Happy news, but we move on to talk about the Sounders, and they were off over the weekend because of the international break. Not happier news for the USMNT, which lost 2-0 at home on Friday night to Costa Rica.
So what does this mean for the USMNT in World Cup qualifying?
They're still in pretty decent shape.
They keep losing, and you keep saying this. No, I don't know. Maybe that's not the case. I think they won quite a few games in a row.
A series of games earlier this year where they did not, in fact, lose those games. And that was, you know, good for their chances. After they made the coaching change, after Bruce Arena took over, they had a successful period in CONCACAF World Cup qualifying. And so because of that, they built up a little bit of a cushion. So, I mean, what it means is, first off, you know, Costa Rica and Mexico, they're like clearly top two in the group at this point.
Oh, man.
There's no question about that.
Did Christian Pulisic play in this game?
Yeah, he did. And, I mean, the USMNT had some opportunities and just really struggled to finish. So, tied right now with Honduras, both on 8 points. But if you look at the schedule after the U.S. plays in Honduras, in San Pedro Sula on Tuesday afternoon, before the live show. So after that, in the final round of qualifying.
That's how they're probably counting time also.
In October, the U.S. hosts Panama and travels to Trinidad and Tobago. And then, as contrast to that, Honduras plays at Costa Rica and then hosts Mexico in their final two matches.
Oh, really?
So that's not going to be great for them. Panama also still very much in the mix on 7 points right now. Let's see, their final three matches, they host Trinidad and Tobago on Tuesday, so almost certainly 3 points there, I think you would say. Then face Mexico, and in their final match, they will be at home. So they're at Mexico and then home to Costa Rica. So again, a much more difficult schedule. So
both of the other teams are playing the top two teams.
Right.
Both of the other competitors with the USMNT, and he doesn't have to play them at all.
Well, they'll be playing. Wait, did I get that wrong? We're talking about Panama here. Panama plays in the U.S.
Oh.
Yeah, they play in the U.S. in that next group and then host Costa Rica. So I had them backwards, but still a difficult run for them. And so the U.S., again, with a chance in both of these matches, if they can get a point in Honduras tomorrow, Tuesday, they're in really good shape. Even if they don't get a point, they're still more likely than not to advance to the World Cup.
Really?
Yeah, because, I mean, for among other things, even if you finish in fourth, you still advance to the Inter-Confederation playoffs at that point as part of the qualifying, which would see the U.S. take on fifth place team from the Asian Football Conference. So anyway, the Sounders off.
I'm just judging by the comments online, it felt as though there was no chance of them making the World Cup.
People overreacted to something online? That doesn't sound like people. So we saw Clint Dempsey and Jordan Morris. Dempsey in the 65th minute and Jordan Morris in the 84th both come on as subs for the U.S. on Friday night. The chance that one or both of them may start in Tuesday's match, but still should have ample time, I think, to recover before Sunday. The Sounders resume the MLS schedule against the LA Galaxy at home at 6 p.m. on FS1. Pretty good timing there for a Sunday match during the NFL season.
Yes.
That comfortably after the Seahawks play. The Galaxy, a perennial power who you usually expect them to turn it on the second half of the season, not happening this year.
They didn't Sounders it in the second half.
No, they didn't really have any big midseason additions, so it's kind of a down season for LA, which changed coaches. Ziggy Schmidt, of course, took over before they drew with the Sounders a few weeks ago. They're 17th in soccer power index, According to 538 in the MLS, they have yet to score against the Sounders this year in two matches at home in Carson, California. They drew the one and then lost 3-0 in the other match, and they are allowing 1.53 expected goals per 98 minutes, which is fifth worst in MLS. So a rough go of things for LA, and so hopefully the Sounders can continue that for them.
Yes, Sunday. It seems like a comfortable 3 points for the Sounders.
But we would have said that about Portland, and that was not a comfortable
Portland was a much better team than
LA. Yeah, that's true. We wouldn't have said that, I guess. Yeah, I don't know what I'm saying there. The Seattle Storm wrapped up their regular season on Sunday with an 85-80 win at Chicago. That game was ultimately meaningless for them because they had already been locked into the eighth and final playoff spot in the WNBA, which does not use conferences for their playoffs. Previously, they had lost 110-106 in overtime on Friday at Washington, a solid effort that was highlighted by Sue Bird becoming the all-time WNBA leader with 2,600 career assists.
Toast to Sue Bird.
Absolutely. It
was the most assists of anybody who's ever been on the Paulton cast.
That's true. She's ahead of Rashard Lewis. She's way ahead of... I don't think Ben B has had any professional assists. I don't know about Mina Kimes. You know, she might have, after her career as a nose tackle for the Packers, gone into the WNBA. But it was a little disappointing. She didn't have had a chance to do it at home the previous Sunday in the game they lost to Phoenix and only had three assists in that game when she came in needing six, but then did it in the first quarter at Washington. And it was really in a vintage performance for her. She had 19 points and 13 assists in 34 minutes in that OT.
What does Sue Bird need to have to become the all-time assist leader in the WNBA? She's number one? I think it's second.
No, that was number one. She passed Tisha Panichero.
Wow, another toast to Sue Bird.
Better toast, because now that you actually understand what I was saying.
It's been a long day of moving.
It has been a long day. So the Storm will face Phoenix in a one-game playoff in the WNBA format they went to last year on Wednesday night at 7 p.m. on ESPN2.
So much happening this week between that one-game playoff and the live Pelton cast.
That's true. That's what everyone is saying. They went 1-2 against Phoenix this season, lost both games at home, including that one just a little over a week ago that I mentioned. Both of those close games. And then on the road, they got their first win of the Gary Kloppenberg era as interim head coach at Phoenix earlier in August. So have had experience going down to Phoenix and winning. The Storm finished 5-4 to end the season under Kloppenberg after that coaching change, had a four-game winning streak followed by a four-game losing streak, and then won their finale. Player to watch in this matchup, even though Diana Taurasi is on Phoenix and, you know, still a threat, she had the dagger kind of seal three-pointer to seal that win in Seattle last week. It really is Brittany Griner's team at this point. You know, she's become their go-to player and MVP contender. And against a Storm team that is undersized in the middle, has been very effective, averaged 24.3 points per game on 60.4% shooting in those three matchups head-to-head.
And Breonna Stewart's more of a wing player.
She'll defend Griner. She has a 7-foot wingspan.
So it's Stewie versus Griner. Taurasi versus Bird in this one-game playoff?
Yeah, they will. Taurasi and Bird will not defend each other, but
They don't defend each other just because Diana Taurasi's too big, or?
She's more of a shooting guard.
Huh.
And even really slid down to the three against the Storm in their last meeting when they went to a kind of a three-guard attack in that one. She's played point guards at times in her career, but now they have Kennewick native Leilani Mitchell at point
guard,
who's, I think, someone to watch in this matchup, because when the Storm inevitably double-teams Brittany Griner, because Stewie is just giving up too much size despite her length. Leilani Mitchell is someone who's going to end up with a lot of threes out of that, and she hit a couple of key ones in the fourth quarter of that game last week. So it's interesting, even though Phoenix is the fifth seed and gets to host this game in the Storm, we're the last team into the playoffs at 15-19, the teams actually both had basically even point differentials on the season. So both like should have been 500 teams given average luck in close games. Also of note, this game will be played at the Wells Fargo Center on the ASU campus because the U.S. Airways Center is, or that's not what they call it anymore. I don't know what they call it. It's some casino down there. It's previously booked. And then if the Storm wins,
what's happening there instead?
I don't know. I haven't checked the website. That's a fascinating question to know. If the Storm wins this game, they will move on to take on New York, the number three seed, which has won, I believe, 11 consecutive games to close out the regular season. And that game would be played Sunday at 2 p.m., which would not be good timing relative to the this game. All right, it's Talking Stick Resort Arena now.
That's been settled.
And let's see here. Marvel Universe Live is there this week. So I think that's...
definitely not going to be able to compete with that.
Yeah.
So 2 p.m. on Sunday?
If they win. So we'll see if they can get through to that matchup against New York.
Excellent timing. Slow clap for the WNBA on that one.
That's the tough thing about their season and the length of it. Yeah. All right. With that in the books, I think it's time to get to your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners Hot Takes coming at you.
All right. Well, we've tried a lot of different formats for the Mariners Hot Takes this year, mostly with people who actually watch the Mariners. So this week, we've decided to get hot takes from someone who doesn't watch the Mariners. Our special guest will be joining us the rest of the podcast to talk about the Husky football and Seahawks. We are so thrilled to welcome the foremost third Pelton brother. I think it's fair to say.
The real third Pelton brother.
A member of the Pelton Cast Legion of Boom, coming to us all the way from the East Coast in undisclosed location near Washington, D.C. Ben B., thanks for joining us.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so you don't watch the Mariners, correct?
I do not. The last time I watched a Mariners game was probably in person in Safeco Field in 2001.
Wow.
It's the Ben B. playoff curse.
Yeah. I feel like I'm pretty out on the Mariners because of the fact that, like, you know, I maybe watch, you know, a half dozen games a year, and then I haven't attended a game in a couple years. That is commitment to not watching the Mariners.
I think the last game I might have watched was the divisional round against the Yankees where they were eliminated. I was at one of those games they lost, and it was a soul crushing experience because they won 100
clearly.
They won 116 games that year, and then went against the hated Yankees and lost, and it was bad. And then I stopped watching, and I don't think they've made the playoffs since, so I haven't really missed anything.
That is correct, yes. It was soul-crushing. I mean, I feel like nothing can, you know, everyone talks about how meaningless the NBA regular season is. I mean, obviously the MLB regular season is meaningful because only five teams make the playoffs now. It's five, right?
Yes.
I'm looking to you for confirmation, Tristan.
Oh, in baseball?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, a lot of teams. Basically half the league.
No, it's not the WNBA. It's not that many teams. But, like, if you win 116 games and you don't even make it to the World Series, like, that's a pretty crippling indicator for the regular season, I would say.
Ben B will never watch again. that's what happens. So enough of these don't watch the Mariners takes. Let's talk about football. Let's talk about what we're here to talk about. And if you can believe this, we've never had Ben B on, despite the fact that he's been an ardent supporter, third Pelton brother from the very beginning, from the new very beginning.
Yes,
nobody has done more to popularize us. Yes. Certainly not us,
including us.
Which is weird because Kevin tweets out that he has a podcast on his 80,000 follower Twitter account, and it's very little engagement. And I've spent the last few months telling everybody to listen to Peltoncast, and now all of a sudden, like, everybody I follow on Seahawks Twitter is listening to Peltoncast. So it's really fun to have everybody understand all these inside jokes about local burger chains and
that you don't understand, that you've never been to.
Yeah. I
think that was a Red Robin joke.
Okay.
The jokes and the bingo square and all these things that were only funny to probably you and your family members and me. Now everybody on Twitter understands them, which is really cool.
That is a big addition. It feels like it's much more of a community now. So
yeah,
we're so thankful for your efforts there. Should we start with Husky football? The Huskies opening up the 2017 season last Friday night with a 30-16 win at Rutgers. And I tweeted from the Pelton Cast account, I thought a game where our emotions were well summed up by Coach Pete's reaction to watching that Tristan Vizcaino field goal during the fourth quarter, where he initially started with a grimace because he thought it was going to be way off, and then it hooks and actually goes in. And obviously it's like, okay, not too bad. Is that a fair assessment of our takeaway from this game?
Yeah, it reminded me so much of a Seahawks game where I think it was the very first drive of the game. Rutgers went down the field and the Huskies defense didn't look great. And then the rest of the game, the Huskies defense just looked amazing. But yes, then when you look on Twitter, everyone is just freaking out about the Huskies, even though they're, like, if you look at yards per play or kind of how the game is going, or looking at the win probability graphs on ESPN, like the Huskies were never really in danger of losing that game, but people were just terrified. It was very interesting.
I think that comparison is exactly what I said after, is that it felt just like a Seahawks game, where I was chatting you during the game, Kevin, and I was saying, like, they can just run all over us if they want to. And you're like, they're averaging less than 4 yards per carry. Because it really
4 yards per pass.
Yeah, it did feel like that with Gus Edwards. Like, it felt like he had this amazing game and broke all these tackles and was unstoppable. And he had 24 carries for 79 yards. Yes, that's a hashtag bad game. It was only marginally better than LaVon Coleman, who I think we all feel like had this horrible game. 14 carries for 40 yards. So, yeah, I mean, I think to some extent, even this 30-14 score kind of flatters Rutgers a little bit, yeah, I would say. Yeah.
The yards per play were so in favor of UW.
I do think that the 27.5 point spread, which had dropped to after the Azeem Victor suspension, that was a little ridiculous. Like, it, even though the Huskies had a chance to maybe get there had they not given up that late touchdown and scored one of their own, still, this was not that lopsided of a game.
Is it a hot take to ask how much of Jake Browning being good last year was due to John Ross?
No, I don't think that's a hot take.
There are definitely people saying that. I think it's early to have that opinion. Let's just say, I think it would be too hot of a take to say right now Jake Browning being good last year was because of John Ross. He didn't look maybe as sharp as we would have liked him to in this game, but also, this is basically a preseason game. We were talking about this. You're going from 0 to 100 in college football, especially playing on the road, having to travel across the country. They didn't have an easy landing like they had last year playing Rutgers. This was a much more difficult place for them to play. And I think it just takes a second to kind of get up to speed to playing competitive college football.
Yeah, that's fair. And John Ross just demolishing Rutgers last year was very fun, but also in Husky Stadium, and Rutgers was probably worse last year.
Yeah, I think they definitely were. I mean, I think those grad transfers have helped them considerably. I mean, the other aspect of it is, to me, the one, I mean, concern is maybe too strong, but, you know, the one thing that I'm watching going forward is the offensive line, I think, was a disappointment to me in this game.
Yeah.
Because when Browning struggled, it was usually because he was in third and long and facing pressure and, you know, getting pressure off the edge. There was a couple of a tipped pass and one, you know, one that he rushed. I'm thinking of like this highlights of, like, you know, missed third down opportunities for the Huskies. And it wasn't necessarily Browning missing throws so much as him, you know, being rushed and off balance. And then you know, Gaskin getting going in the second half. But the fact that they were not that effective running the ball, 3.5 yards per carry overall, although that is, I think there was a minus 13 yard on that Jake Browning fumble. I think that takes a big chunk out of the rushing yardage. But which, by the way, college football, it's 2017. Can we count sacks as passes now? Like they do in the NFL? There's my rant for the day. Yeah, so I mean, the other thing we haven't brought up here is Rutgers was generally playing eight in the box here to try to stop the run, and the Huskies didn't necessarily attack that really aggressively by throwing on early downs in this game, I wouldn't say. All right, don't all comment on that at once.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess I was wondering if we can go through quickly. Okay, let's say how much of Jake Browning's credit is to John Ross. We don't know, but if we can talk just level of panic, right? Let's play a quick game with the Huskies. How panicked are we after week one? And it could be low for everybody. Let's start with Jake Browning, though. How panicked are we?
I'm not really panicked at all. I mean, the deep ball that he did have to Dante Pettis, he showed arm strength that wasn't there in the second half of last season when he was dealing with the, you know, that injury issue. So I'm not concerned at all about Jake.
Ben, are you panicked about Jake Browning?
I wouldn't say panicked, but, and this is a totally unfair comparison, but the difference in arm strength between, like, watching Russell Wilson on Sundays and Jake Browning, right after that deep ball, there was the third and goal where he tried to make the throw to the sideline, and the ball was just really, really slow, and the defender had a chance to break on it. Like, it just, it looked like watching Austin Davis in the Seahawks preseason game. So it's not really panic, because that's just what Jake Browning is, and we saw that last year the Huskies can succeed with what he is, but it's not, he's not Russell Wilson.
Bold take. Jake Browning not as good as before. Also, by the way, the Rutgers quarterback Kyle Bolin turns out not as good as Russell Wilson.
No.
What about the run game? So we saw Miles Gaskin look very good. I think offensively was the best player on the field in this game. Had 7 carries for 59 yards. But LaVon Coleman just seemed like he couldn't get anything going in this one, which was a little bit surprising for me. How panicked are we about this?
Again, pretty low. I mean, I think that, you know, he's more of the between the tackles runner here. So he's probably going to be somewhat more affected by Rutgers putting Nate in the box. And, I think he is due for regression to the mean this year from the, 8 yards per carry he averaged last year. Like, he's not going to do that again, but I don't think he's going to average 3 yards a carry either.
Yeah, definitely not panicked, but it was very surprising, even on this very pelting pass, how excited we were for Gaskin and Coleman, and especially against Rutgers, and just expecting to run all over them like Texas A&M ran all over UCLA, although that didn't end up well for them. But,
hey, but it's hard. The run.
Yeah, A&M established the run so hard.
The gift that you had of their running back dancing before halftime, I was like, they're going to lose this game. When you celebrate that much before halftime, you're going to lose.
That was not my takeaway when I was seeing the score. I was like, Texas A&M is dancing on UCLA's grave.
What are your feelings about Jim Mora, Ben?
There were so many shots of both him and Rosen where they just looked distressed on the sideline, and it was very fun to watch.
Yes.
I don't think anybody in Seattle likes Jim Mora.
I mean, no, there's definitely a Jim Mora contingent that I think wanted him to get hired for the UW job a couple of years ago.
There are some holdouts.
Oh, man.
I was so ready to pour dirt on his grave after that game.
The alternative of Jim Mora going to Coach Peterson is such a massive difference.
Okay, so what about the receiving core? We're talking about John Ross, probably unique talent considering he's the 8th pick in the draft. Do we feel like there was the same kind of separation from the receivers in this game? Were they getting open for Jake Browning? How panicked are we about the receiving core?
I mean, that's always hard to tell when you're watching the TV feed, if you're not watching, the all 22s or something like that. I mean, a good performance, I think, for Dante Pettis, but you definitely see that beyond him, no other receiver had more than one catch. They involved a lot of different receivers, but it was Drew Sample and then Miles Gaskin who ended up being the security blankets for Jake Browning. So I would say I'm not feeling great about the Husky receivers at this point.
Yeah, Pettis looks good. Gaskin looks amazing as a receiver, and nobody else really seemed that great. So maybe they will miss Ross, but again, it's so early that it's hard to, like, maybe somebody else will emerge soon.
Yes, there's definitely a spot there for somebody like, I mean, Bichelia didn't really stand out. Braden Lenius didn't really stand out. Even Chico McClatcher, who I thought maybe would have a bigger game here, really didn't see much from any of them. There's definitely a spot there for some receiver to make an impact.
For sure.
And then you mentioned the offensive line. Like, clearly the thing that we were expecting, that we were most surprised about in this game. How panicked are we about the offensive line?
I mean, I think my threat level is guarded at this point. I'm not sure which one that is anymore, but it's up a little bit from where it was going into the season, where I was feeling really confident about the experienced depth that you had on the line.
If they have the same, mostly the same personnel that was really good last year, then shouldn't they eventually be good again this year?
You would think. One would think.
Yeah, maybe Rutgers is just really good.
I mean, it's hard to know.
This is such a Seahawks conversation, because our definition of the opponent who we just beat by 16 points is really good. There are many times when I've left a game against the Rams being like, that team is just unbeatable. And then defensively, quickly, the D-line, it felt like they were getting pushed around a little bit at first, definitely settled in and had a pretty good game. I saw that Pro Football Focus, I think Vita Vea was one of their top-rated players, was the top-rated player in the game, and they said was disrupting everything.
Yeah, and then Adam Jude was noting that the Husky coaching staff picked Greg Gaines as one of their top performers of the week, so they thought he was the more effective of the defensive lineman. So a bit of a difference of opinion there. I mean, you know, that's certainly a place where I think there's enough depth to feel pretty good. I mean, the linebacking core is probably where you come out of this game with some concerns. Ben Burke-Hervin did have 11 tackles.
But they were without their best linebacker.
Getting that start. Yeah, I mean, you were missing Azeem Victor, and I think you saw him missing in this game.
And then the secondary, something that Joel Klatt felt like Rutgers should really be testing more. It was like, please do. Every single time that Rutgers tried to test the secondary, the secondary fared very well. Byron Murphy, and would this be considered his first start?
This is his first game, wasn't it?
It's the first game that he ever played.
He redshirted last season.
My God, where does Coach Pete keep finding these players? He's so good at coaching secondary.
I mean, he kept getting interceptions in like fall camp, and it was like, should we be concerned about the quarterbacks? But no, it turns out that Byron Murphy is just that good at getting interceptions. It's an incredible thing. And I mean, obviously that's not the most important skill for a quarterback, but it's a really nice thing to have.
Yeah, the only time they really, there's that one play where Rutgers scored the touchdown when the UW back fell over, and that, like, there was contact.
It was an OPI.
The defender was in. Yeah.
It was an OPI, and he was down, but okay. Yeah.
We know that we can't complain about these too much with Kevin here, so.
No, that one I did think was.
Really?
It deserved to be mentioned on the broadcast, the possible OPI. That was when. Yes, that was when they went to the bench. I can't remember who that was anymore.
Yeah, me neither. And then there was, maybe we should put the starter back in. But even that, the process was good. The defender was in place. He just fell down.
Yes.
And then, so, you know, it was pointed out, Jordan Miller on the other side of the field really wasn't tested at all almost by Rutgers. But I think, you know, as impressive as Byron Murphy was in his first start, I think in many ways I was equally impressed by Miles Bryant playing in the slot. And that's, you know, an important position in modern college football because you're going to be tested by such a variety of different players, whether it's running backs out of the backfield, having to match up at times with tight ends, having to match up with, you know, quality slot receivers. So you gotta be able to cover, number one, and then number two, you also have to be able to tackle. And that's obviously a place where Buda Baker was such a phenomenal weapon for the Huskies the last couple of years. And Bryant came in, and, you know, nobody's Buda Baker, but he did a really impressive job for another guy making his first career start and his first career appearance.
Okay, so that was Rutgers. Maybe not as celebratory of a game as we would have liked, but they got through it. That's all that matters. We'll probably never think about this game ever again.
I would imagine probably
nope.
Not. All right, so next Saturday, the Huskies back home to take on Montana in their home opener. Montana coming off a 45-23 win over Valparaiso in their season opener. I was not aware that Valparaiso had a football team. I don't know if a member of the Drew family coach
was going to say head
team.
Coach Bryce Drew.
They entered the season ranked 147th by Sager and ahead of many FBS programs, despite being in the FCS. And despite a down season last year, this is a team that has a history of being pretty good in the Big Sky Conference. But last year went 6-5, including 3-5 in conference play. And it was the second season for innovative coach Bob Stitt, who was formerly at the Colorado School of Mines. And I would say...
I've been following him that time.
Well, people have been following him. Because I would describe Bob Stitt as, he's like your favorite coach's favorite coach. He's like a real coach's coach, especially in the air raid circles. Let me just say,
neither Coach Pete or Pete Carroll, Bob Stitt is their favorite coach, but okay.
No, yeah, I mean, they're operating in slightly different circles. It's true. But possibly if you're a Coug fan, possibly Mike Leach. I can't rule that out.
Do you think he's Coug fans' favorite coach?
Mike Leach? It's doing well. They won a game against an FCS opponent, 31-9. It's going well for the Cougars.
Like, they didn't have to play Colorado School of Mines.
Good for them.
It's Colorado School of Mines?
I'm pretty sure that's right. Okay.
I think that's a real school.
I have no idea what they do there, but I assume it involves mines. they sit there and play Minesweeper all day and say, these mines aren't going to sweep themselves.
Oh, no.
Basically, we have like the air raid coaches clinics where all the coaches go to talk about the air raid. And Bob Stitt was like one of the big innovators there. And he gained a lot of fame a few years ago when West Virginia won the Orange Bowl. They had a lot of success using this fly sweep play that involved a pitch instead of a handoff to the quarterback to the wide receiver. Sweepy around is the quote unquote fly, which is a U2 reference. And so he mentioned
Bob Stitt also is a notable U2 fan. Only the 90s era. He thinks I've gotten a little bit too mainstream lately.
So you mentioned after the game, Dana Holgerson, the West Virginia coach, gave credit to Bob Stitt for implementing this play. So, you know, that kind of really boosted his profile in the X's and O's world.
That's how you get the job at Montana.
I mean, it's weird. He had a very tough time getting a job.
I just like the idea that he's the cock of the walk at the air raid mixer.
I mean, it's like the whole thing of like, you know, your favorite artist. It's like someone who has no mainstream popularity, but all this street cred in the industry. And that's exactly what Bob Stitt was.
Is there actually an Air Raid conference, though?
I think so. I think they get together.
It's an Air Raid conference. It's like the Player Haters Ball.
Yeah. It's like they're renting out a Hilton ballroom or something. But yeah, I think they all go to like someone's college and then they hang out and talk about the Air Raid.
They go to the Applebee's.
Maybe they go to Key West. I don't know what they do there. I'm an expert in this. This is not an oral history of Air Raid conferences.
I would love to be invited to this.
So, among other things, his offense at Montana, noted for the wide splits of their wide receivers. They really spread the length of the field to try to force the defense into man coverage and be able to read that and, you know, pick that apart. Also very effective, I think, against blitzes. So I doubt we'll see a lot of that from the Huskies. They'll probably just try to get pressure against from their front four. And this does seem like a good matchup for the Huskies, because if there's anyone you trust to play, man coverage, it's UW's secondary against a Montana passing attack.
Well, I remember Sonny Dykes doing that at Cal, being shocked because we have seats in the very end zone and looking out and seeing how far their receivers were from the line of scrimmage.
I would say that he is definitely Sonny Dykes' favorite coach.
Sonny Dykes, who's not head coach anywhere anymore. Maybe he's at Colorado School of Mines now.
So they're breaking in a new starting quarterback, Reese Phillips, who's a transfer from Kentucky and playing for the first time really this year as a redshirt senior. He went 27 of 38 for 381 yards, 4 touchdowns, and an interception in his starting debut on Saturday against Valparaiso. And their leading receiver was sophomore Jerry Louis McGee, which is way too many first names, who had 9 catches for 159 yards and a pair of touchdowns. And that's what you need to know about Montana.
That's a lot more than I knew about Montana.
It's more than I knew this morning about Montana, too. So I learned a lot. Do we have any thoughts on this game?
Is there anything that we're looking for in this game specifically? I mean, I think getting LaVon Coleman going would be nice. Basically, everything that they didn't do particularly well against Rutgers, they'll have the opportunity to do well here.
And I think, you know, like I said, this is a different test for the secondary than Rutgers was. Rutgers wasn't going to test them deep, wasn't effective testing them deep. And so it's basically about, you know, maintaining, keeping guys in front of you, making plays in that situation, avoiding long gains, that sort of thing. This will be a different test for the secondary. So it'll be interesting to see how they come out of that. But mostly, I think, you know, this and next week against Fresno State are hopefully an opportunity to get some of the depth guys some experience in the second half.
Yeah, don't get injured, win the game, and go on to next week. And if the offensive line is going to be good this season, then you would like them to look good on Saturday.
Exactly, yeah.
How is Stanford doing? What did the USC game this weekend make you feel about the upcoming showdown between Stanford and USC?
Oh, man. So not to get too far into a Stanford digression because no one else cares, but 2 out of Stanford's next 3 games are USC and UCLA. So after last night, like, oh, is UCLA good too? And then if that's so, that's 2 really good teams in September, which will probably in part decide the conference. But back to your question, I didn't see any of the USC game, but it sounds like people were saying that Darnold wasn't playing very well, which is very encouraging. But it's still, USC always terrifies me no matter how well or bad they're playing. They just have so much talent that they always have the chance to be good in any given game, even if they aren't particularly good that season. And they're supposed to be good this year, so it'd be kind of surprising if they weren't.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, though, in some ways, like, they're really, USC's really dangerous when they seem to be down because they still got all that talent. And then usually when they're good, they're overrated because of the fact that people don't consider any weaknesses among that talent. I feel like, so
yep,
I'm going whichever direct, I'm going against whatever people are saying against USC is my conclusion here. They are
they are
6.5-point favorites in this game. Do you feel like that's too high for USC against Stanford?
It's really weird because they're favorites and I think they should be favorites, but then I checked FPI and FPI gives Stanford like a 60% chance of winning, which just sounds insane.
Yeah,
the game is in LA, so maybe it's reacting a lot to Stanford just destroying Rice, which I don't think should be given that much weight because it's Rice. But yeah, I would not favor Stanford to win. It's possible they win, but I don't think they should be the favorites.
I just can't believe that they're playing USC and UCLA in consecutive weeks in September.
2 of the next 3 weeks.
Or they have a bye in between there, or do they have another game?
They had a bye this week.
They have a mediocre opponent in between them. I think it's like a patty cake non-conference game, but USC and Stanford always play at weird times because they both have to fit in playing Notre Dame later,
right?
And that's in the Pac-12, usually in the Pac-12 schedule, so they often play in September, which, yeah, it's kind of crazy to be this early.
Man, I do not like that at all.
All right, so back to Huskies and chances of victory for this game for UW. Ben, why don't you start us
off? I think I want to use an integer. I think best sums up their chances of victory is 100%.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
So FPI is 98.6%. And if they played 100 times, I think it's more likely 100 times.
All right, I'm going to go 98%.
It's going to go 95. I did not expect to be the most conservative there. I really like the 100% prediction. That's very bold.
Yeah. If they lose, then we know that my prediction.
We assumed that we were going to bring the economist on and he was going to think probabilistically like we did. And it turns out now.
Maybe he is thinking probabilistically by saying 100%.
100%, 50% of the time. It works every time. All right, let's get to the main event. The Seahawks.
Ben's birthday.
So this is my birthday. And thanks for having me on my birthday. And this is the second best thing that's happened to me on my birthday after 2014, when the Seahawks raised the Super Bowl banner on September 4th and then beat the Packers by 20 points.
Oh, man. Were you there at that game?
Thank you. Yeah, I was. I came once the schedule was released and the banner raising was going to be on my birthday. I was like, I have to go. And then I went. And it was one of the best days of my life. It was fantastic.
Yeah, that was fun. I remember that. Well, let's hope that beginning the season with the Packers fares as well as it did that year.
Do we hope? I mean, it was...
That game? What, you didn't think that was a good game?
I thought you meant the season. I mean, the season didn't go poorly by any stretch of the imagination. But I hope it goes as well as the season they started at Carolina, right?
Okay. Went to the Super Bowl. Your standard... Like, where are we at? What is happening when you're saying that's bad?
I'm picking a season to emulate. 2014 isn't the season I'm picking.
Well, we're just talking about the Packers game.
Let's start by talking about the past 72 hours in Seahawks football.
But wait, a happy birthday first is in order.
Oh, okay. Well,
cheers.
Yeah, a birthday toast to Ben.
All right, a toast to Ben.
Thank you. I'm cheering with my Kirkland Signature Pale Ale from local grocery store Costco.
Oh, wow. That is a staple of your uncle's refrigerator. Doesn't matter who your uncle is. He has Kirkland Signature beer.
It was left over from a party, so it's not my fault.
You would have it. Your uncle's house left over from a party.
Oh, that's perfect.
Yeah.
So the last 72 hours in Seahawks, I guess first off, let's get your take on the Sheldon Richardson trade, which I think was in some ways perhaps more measured than much of Seahawks Twitter.
I think my take is very similar to your take, which is not surprising because a lot of how I view draft picks and club control and stuff like that is from reading your articles on ESPN Insider. So maybe our views are very closely aligned because of that. But I think a lot of people discount giving up a second round pick, which is a really valuable pick and a chance to get somebody on a very cheap contract. Like Frank Clark, for example, is a second round pick and has been tremendously valuable. And they still have 2 more years of paying him basically nothing. So it's very exciting to have Sheldon Richardson, and it makes the Seahawks better in 2017, unquestionably, but it kind of puts more eggs into the 2017 basket and less into the other basket. So you're kind of hoping that everything goes right this season, there aren't any major injuries, and hopefully they win the Super Bowl.
That's how I like to go into every season. the Sheldon Richardson or not, with those things. The more that I thought about it over time, and especially like reading the tweets from national writers being like, I don't think you people understand. The Seahawks just added Sheldon Richardson. It's like, okay, like, let's cool off here a little bit.
Like, guys, let's see him play one game at the position, let alone in the Seahawks scheme. Like, I'm sure he's played snaps at three technique in the 3-4 for the Jets, but he was moving to a totally new position here, guys. He was an outside linebacker much of last year.
How much do we think they'll even play him on Sunday? Like, it seems like Carroll's very, very particular about run fits and being in position, and he's only going to have 3 or 4 practices with the team. How many snaps is he going to get?
Well, they don't have a lot of alternatives at defensive tackle at this point. Yes. To preview something we're going to talk about in a second.
I made a comparison, which I wish that I could say on this podcast, about what it was like with Sheldon Richardson coming over. But it was as if he demanded that the Seahawks clear house on the defensive line.
Yeah, they got rid of everyone. So I think he's going to have to play from that standpoint. I mean, my first thought when you said that is, well, they'll just play him on, you know, in passing situations, use him as part of that, you know, kind of exciting four-man front we've talked about to get for pressure. But no, he's going to have to play on front downs too, because there's not much else there. I think the other interesting thing that's come out since the trade is Peter King saying in this morning's MMQB column, the Seahawks plan to try hard to sign Richardson beyond this year, and it'll cost quite a bit. So that's, you know, interesting in the context of, you know, was this a one-year deal or is this a long-term move?
It sounds like Peter King fodder, though. Somebody fed it to him because they want people to see that publicly. But, like, of course, sure. What does that amount to? Basically nothing. This is before the season. That's at the end of the season. There's a lot that can happen between then. I'm sure that the Seahawks would say that they want to try to sign every player who's a free agent.
But plan to try hard is different than plan to try to re-sign. I mean, I think the one thing in terms of costing quite a bit is, you know, the franchise tag being a relatively low number for a defensive tackle gives them some leverage here in these negotiations.
And even if they get a season out of him this year and next year on the franchise tag, then they can still make the trade worth it. That's probably 2 years at elite production without paying a whole lot for it.
Especially if then you get a comp pick on the back end of it to lessen the hit of giving up that second round pick. All right, so Saturday, after we were all reeling from the trade of Jermaine Kearse and celebrating the fact that it assuredly meant that Kason Williams had made the roster to replace him, the Seahawks just purging all Huskies from their roster, including Marcel Reese, who may be back after week one, unexpectedly waive Kason Williams and keep five wide receivers. Tristan, do you want to start out on this? It's a loyal member of Kason crew.
I honestly have a very measured take on this, which is I can see it from the Seahawks perspective. I'm not going to say anything bad about Kason Williams because there's nothing bad to say about Kason Williams. But when you compare somebody who is an undrafted free agent, who, I mean, you control their contract through this year versus somebody that you invested a third round pick in and you're going to be controlling their contract for how many years?
Four years, yeah.
So you're going to be controlling them for 4 years. You have all of their potential, all of their development that happens. Honestly, Kason Williams, I think, is a competent NFL receiver, but there are a lot of Kason Williams out there.
What if the choice was between Kason and McAvoy? What is the argument? Why do you think they kept McAvoy over Kason if that's what it was?
It makes it a little bit tougher, but I think we have seen Tanner McAvoy contribute to the team in actual NFL games that count. And I think that's definitely part of it. He has experience being on the roster, playing in games, doing a lot of different things. And the thing that we were so excited about Tanner McAvoy about last year, which was he was a quarterback in college. He could do all sorts of different things. He also played on defense in college, right? I mean, Tanner McAvoy, what he provides as far as versatility goes. I mean, Zach Wittman was talking about this on Twitter, which is that the Seahawks fall in love with people who can do everything. And I don't, I honestly think maybe from the Seahawks perspective, him being able to do everything is worth maybe the slight decrease between him and Kason Williams as a receiver. And also as a receiver, he seems like he gets into space. Tanner McAvoy seems to get open pretty often and can make plays by going up and getting the ball.
And I guess I would say that my take is, like, look, I think that probably Kason Williams is slightly better than Tanner McAvoy. He's probably better than Amari Darbo right now, although the long-term consideration kind of affects that. But I think the one thing people need to take in consideration is, like, there's, if we look at the confidence interval of where we think that these guys are players, there's a huge degree of overlap between Kason Williams and Tanner McAvoy and Amari Darbo, and, you know, probably throw some other people in there too. Like, they might be better, they might not. Who knows? Even the Seahawks, who have watched them practice, have seen so much more of these guys than we have in four preseason games and whatever we've seen of them in the regular season in the past. They don't really know at the end of the day. That's why you see Spencer Ware goes to Kansas City and becomes a star running back. You know, this is just very unpredictable, but you have to make choices in that. And was Kason Williams the single best, you know, was keeping someone over Kason Williams the single best choice? I would say probably not. And that the fact that he was claimed by the first team with waiver priority is probably an indication of that. So
where do you stand on this, Ben?
I think, well, I'm not as in love with Kaysen as many other people, so I don't really...
Imagine he was Christian McCaffrey emotionally.
Oh, man. If the Panthers cut Christian McCaffrey, I would riot on the internet.
I'm pretty sure Cleveland would pick him up, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I understand why it's frustrating for fans. The team does preach the always compete, and the preseason games are what fans see, and Kaysen was indisputably better in the preseason games, which are all that we really have access to. So I see why people are upset, but in terms of like predicting the percent chance that the Seahawks are going to win the Super Bowl, does this move the needle at all? I don't think so.
Which is, I feel like, a very 2017 or like a post-Twitter era thing, where back in the day, you read about these cuts. Maybe you heard about them on the radio on Saturday afternoon, but you probably read about them in the Sunday morning paper, and it was hard to get as worked up over them as it is now. Like, the smallest things become such
like,
a big
they
deal
cut Jerome Paython
on Seahawks Twitter. Hey, let's not say anything ill of Jerome Paython. Let's be careful here. But a couple months later, does it really matter what happened? No, you probably have forgotten it by that point. You're on to something else. Some play that happened in the third quarter of a week 8 game that suddenly that seems like the biggest thing in the world. But the other aspect of it is... What I think is interesting is the response from Richard Sherman, who obviously is seeing practice. It's tough to say whether this is just Richard Sherman being kind of an emotional guy or whether Kaysen Williams legitimately was that good throughout practice as well as preseason games, and that this really is kind of undermining the always compete philosophy.
Yeah, it's kind of... So Richard Sherman is one of my favorite players, and I love him, but at the same time, he can be really annoying, and I think this is one of those times. So I think we play about... Darbo versus Kaysen and Sherman basically saying that Kaysen was better, but Kaysen's been in the league for 3 years and he's older than Darbo, so of course he's better right now, but that's not the only thing that matters, because Darbo's under contract for this year and the next 3 years after that at a very reasonable price, so that has to be a factor as well.
All right, well, enough of that topic that we just concluded doesn't actually mean that much. Let's get to the Seahawks and the Packers opening
but
up
season. We should talk more about what's happened. I mean, there's been a lot of transactions here. We don't want to talk about the practice squad at all, nothing. We're just moving on to the Packers?
I mean...
How about this? How about
guys,
this?
That makes sense to be on... I mean, should we talk about the fact that they did release Ataba Rubin?
There are a lot of people who deserve at least a second. They traded Tremaine Brock. They released Ataba Rubin. This has to be something.
All right, fine. I just don't want to get bogged down in this.
Okay.
I mean, I was surprised by that, because I think Ataba Rubin was a big factor in the Seahawks having the number 3 rush defense in the NFL next year. And I think people are expecting, you know, Sheldon Richardson to come in and be just as good as a run defender and also provide an interior pass rush. And I think that expectation is unrealistic. I think Sheldon Richardson will likely be a downgrade as a run defender.
Did you hear Pete today saying they're still looking for a DT, defensive tackle?
Well, again, I mean, they've got 3 on the roster right now, right? Because they...
So they why did they get rid of Rubin?
It's kind of baffling.
I mean, I think
between
it's mostly
Quinton Jefferson and Ataba Rubin.
I mean, in Rubin's case, I think it's probably mostly a of getting his bonus split across the next 2 years, but I don't know, maybe that doesn't make any sense anyway. I mean, I guess you get the rollover on next year without his base salary.
Yeah.
I assume that's it, but yeah, the fact that then they cut Quinton Jefferson and then also Co, who I thought, you know, he flashed during the preseason, to quote our friend Danny Kelly. So that was all very surprising. It does seem like I was expecting them to claim someone off waivers to fill another defensive tackle spot.
Yeah, it sounded like they had I can't remember whose tweet it was, but they had a plan to recoup the draft pick or the draft investment that traded for Richardson. And it sounded like that the plan was to trade Lane and trade Rubin, and then nobody wanted either one of those players, and then they just cut Rubin.
And so their plan was to get a second round pick out of Jeremy Lane and Ataba Rubin?
I mean, I think
just some draft capital.
And then maybe something close to equivalent, like if you get a 4th and a 5th or something like that. So they did recoup a 7th round pick out of Tremaine Brock, which is in some way the most amazing piece of business possible. You sign a guy a week into training camp, and 3 weeks later you trade him for a 7th round pick.
Yeah, they're like house flippers with Tremaine Brock.
I prefer to think of it as like you start with the paperclip and you end up trading it into a house.
Like, yeah, they're like people trading on Craigslist.
What's amazing is Brock had multiple offers, but he signed with the Seahawks because they were the ones that stood by him in the beginning. And then once they were offered a seventh round pick for him, they just traded him.
that's all their loyalty is worth.
I mean, presumably they weren't like totally enamored of what they saw from him in practice, I guess.
But then they also reclaim some draft value by getting their own seventh round draft pick back.
Wait, what?
Plus, yeah. I believe a fifth round pick from New England for Cassius Marsh. Did you forget this trade happened?
Was that their own? That was their own pick.
They got their own pick. They traded for Justin Coleman.
Okay, yeah. I mean, the Marsh trade. Yeah, that was surprising. I did not see that coming. And presumably,
no, he looked good.
Presumably, a side effect of the fact that with Richardson playing in that nickel package, you no longer need as much depth at defensive end in the nickel, I guess.
Yeah, I wonder what, because this would have been the last year of his deal. So if he walked after this year, I wonder what sort of comp pick he would have, like, would he have earned a fifth round comp pick anyway?
Yeah, I mean, it would have depended on the kind of season he had. Also, probably a statement that they like what they saw from David Bass in the preseason, who was quite effective.
Yeah.
I mean, keeping Marcus Smith was a little bit of a surprise to me as another defensive end. He's someone I think, along with the 10 offensive linemen who could be on the bubble when they do go out and sign a defensive tackle, as they assuredly will for depth there. So that's worth watching.
Or Jordan Ruse. To me, Jordan Ruse is number one on the list of people who's going to get cut.
And I think there's kind of a value in like cutting someone slightly after cut down day. I feel like they're less likely to get claimed afterwards. Am I crazy to think that?
There's a value to hurting their long-term future.
Well, just you get them, sneak them through and get them on the practice squad.
Have we noted that Ibushi made the team?
Well, yeah, I mentioned that on our drive over here, actually. Okay. Because it wasn't until this afternoon at Pete Carroll's press conference that we found out that Glowinski had won the right guard job, therefore making Ibushi a reserve and invalidating my hot take.
Your hot take before was that he was going to get released. Then you revised your hot take. So you've been wrong about two hot takes here.
Right, that's fair.
You revised your hot take to being if he wasn't the starter, then he would be released.
I'm owning that. I mean,
wrong twice.
After he started at left guard against the Raiders, I started to think, because he hadn't played left guard at all. And that was my big thing. Can we finally transition to talking about the Packers? Because if you want to talk about cut down day, segue into the Packers. The common theme here from last year's cutdown day in the Packers, Jari Evans, who is the replacement for TJ Lang at right guard for the Green Bay Packers after being cut by the Seahawks at the end of training camp last year because of the fact that he had no positional versatility and could only play right guard.
The Seahawks played Jamarcus Webb against Aaron Donald in week 2 because they didn't want to keep Jari Evans on the roster.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Speaking of the Seahawks overvaluing versatility at the expense of...
Has Aaron Donald reported to camp?
He has.
Oh, he has?
No, he hasn't. You're right. He hasn't.
This is the best news. This is all we should be talking about. We should have weekly coverage of the Aaron Donald holdout.
We really should. That would have been a good weekly segment to do. Can we please talk about...
Okay, the Packers.
So, coming off of their loss in last year's NFC Championship game, the Packers, in typical fashion, not very aggressive in free agency. I guess atypical a little bit that they let some of their own guys walk. Lang, most notably, also Micah Hyde at safety, one of the three safeties who saw a lot of action for them last season. And then Eddie Lacy, of course, who signed with the Seahawks as a running back. So, you know, they're perhaps even more than usual reliant on young depth from their own team. They did go out and sign maybe, you know, their most aggressive free agent move in a while, bring in Martellus Bennett. So it's the Bennett brothers
the Bennett
against
Bowl.
Each other.
This is basically Clegane Bowl. I think this is happening at a big moment. They've played each other before, but never so much at such a big moment.
Yeah, never with so much on the line. But, you know, at running back, they've got Ty Montgomery, they converted to that position last year, I'm sure is a Ben favorite from his Stanford days.
Oh, yeah. Blake Martinez, too, at linebacker.
Yeah. And then at cornerback, they also brought back Devon House, who had played for them previously and then was really ineffective after he'd signed with Jacksonville as a free agent. But they're relying a lot on a couple of young guys that they drafted there. And then also Kevin King, at some point, we assume is going to find his way into the mix. It doesn't look like he's going to beat the Seahawks in week 1, like your nightmare scenario after the draft.
I'm okay with that. I would rather him be buried on the depth chart.
All right. So do we want to start here with when the Green Bay offense is on the field?
Yeah, so tell us about Green Bay's offense.
So they're very good. If you've heard this. Fourth last year in DVOA by Football Outsiders, projected this year to improve to number 3. The addition of Bennett could be a big factor for them. Yeah, he had a 33.4% DVOA last year in New England, as opposed to Jared Cook, the perpetually underachieving former Packers tight end who was a minus 11.5% DVOA playing with Aaron Rodgers, which is almost unthinkable. So that's one more weapon for them to go alongside, you know, their trio of wide receivers, which, you know, kind of midway through last year, it seemed like there were some question marks about how good their wide receivers really were at creating separation. But then in the second half of the season, everything just clicked, and all of a sudden they were back to being the devastating passing attack that we know, and I definitely would not say love. Fear?
I fear.
Yeah, I think that's the appropriate, especially after what they did to the Seahawks in last season when the Seahawks went into Green Bay without Earl Thomas, which was bad.
That was bad. That was a bad day.
Still have nightmares about that one, possibly.
Nothing really good happens in that stadium.
So what do you foresee happening, Ben, when Green Bay is on offense? What do you see from them?
Do we know who... So when Green Bay is on offense, who are going to be the three... assuming they have three wideouts on the field, who are going to be the three cornerbacks that Seattle puts out? It'll be Sherman, Lane, and Griffin?
I think it's Griffin.
Yeah, we don't know for sure, though. That's going to be a fascinating thing to watch, how quickly Coleman can work his way into the mix.
And so we saw Aaron Rodgers go against the first drive last year. There was a 70-yard completion, Aaron Rodgers picking on Lane to Davante Adams for a touchdown.
I remember that.
And yeah, that was bad. So even Aaron Rodgers against Lane scares me, and he's not even like the biggest question mark, which is going to be the other quarterback. So I don't feel good about this at all.
You know, the really thing that really surprised me when I was going back and looking at the Packers in terms of DVOA, because I hadn't remembered this, they actually had a higher rushing offense rank last year than they did passing offense. They had the fifth best rushing DVOA and the seventh best passing DVOA. And a fair bit of that was, in fact, Eddie Lacy, who averaged 5.1 yards per carry last year before his injury. Some of that was Aaron Rodgers being really effective in as a scrambler, but then they brought in Montgomery, who previously was a wide receiver throughout his career, and he averaged over 5 yards per carry for them the rest of the season, which is pretty incredible.
And Christian Michael is kind of good for them at points, too.
Yes, sadly, he will not be involved in this year's matchup. It is not a Christian Michael revenge game. All right, if we flip to the other side of the football, the Packers defense, obviously the weaker aspect of this team, 20th last year in DVOA and projected to drop a little bit to 21st. In addition to the losses we mentioned, also lost Julius Peppers, who returned to Carolina as a free agent. He was their leader last year, or their second on the team, I should say, with 7.5 sacks. And that means that Clay Matthews, who had just 5 sacks last season, playing a lot of inside linebacker, moves outside on a more regular basis, presumably this season. Although, you know, they do still have some depth issues at outside linebacker, and ended up very recently signing former 49er Ahmad Brooks, who had 6 sacks last year but is aging at 33, to kind of create some depth in that pass rush position.
Yeah, it's not... So the only research I did for this was looking at Green Bay's pass rush, and they had a very democratic pass rush. So they had 5 players who had between 17 and 22 pressures last year, which is like in the ballpark of a guy like Frank Clark. And they lost, of those 5 guys, they lost 2 of them, Peppers and also Dayton Jones. I'm probably butchering his name. So if they have 5 guys who are any threat at all to rush the quarterback, and no one else on their team had more than 7 pressures, then 2 of those guys are gone. So that's good. But our tackles are Ifedi and Reese Odhiambo. So we'll see what they look like. And then they're first NFL action at tackle.
And I mean, another thing to watch here, you know, we haven't seen obviously the offensive line deal with a lot of complicated stunts and rushes during the preseason. That's, you know, one thing they naturally don't have to deal with that will be different starting this week. But Green Bay in particular, Dom Capers really loves him some defensive back blitzes, partially because they often have 6 defensive backs on the field. They had the second highest percentage of plays in with at least 6 defensive backs on the field last year, with 29%, according to the Football Outsiders research. And they were also second highest in defensive back blitzes and 4th in sacks by defensive backs. So that's something else to watch out for here.
Yeah, you'd hope that the Seahawks would be used to defensive back blitzes from playing Arizona twice a year, but
it never seemed to play.
We'll see. Yeah.
So what do we expect when the Seahawks have the ball here? I mean, it seems to me like it's not a good place to be starting in Green Bay, naturally.
No. What?
What is that in Alexa?
Alexa is letting
us know. I said Seattle Seahawks and Alexa is informing us about it. I'll ask later who the best quarterback in the NFL is. Is that the one that says Russell Wilson, of course?
I think so.
Alexa, who's the best quarterback in the NFL?
If I had to pick a quarterback to win one game, it would be Aaron Rodgers.
Oh!
You have to ask it who the best, I think, American football player is.
Alexa said, if I had to choose a quarterback to win one game, it would be Aaron Rodgers. You don't, Alexa.
Wow. Disloyal.
God. Wow. Part of a team setting. But it seems like the Seahawks should be able to move the ball here.
Yeah, I mean, you would think so. The Green Bay defense is just generally not very good. So I think, and another interesting thing to watch here, the Packers basically never play base defense. And one of the things they're planning to do this year is part of their nickel. They're calling it the quote-unquote nitro nickel, where they're going to move Morgan Burnett, their nominal strong safety, down to linebacker in sort of a similar role to Deion Buchanan. The trendy thing in the NFL to do now is to play a safety as a linebacker. So I don't know who's actually playing safety for them when they have this alignment. That was one thing that the article said.
That's what makes it nitro.
I also don't know who's actually playing cornerback for them at this point, because that's very in flux. But, you know.
Yeah, I looked at their chart, and so it says it's House and Rollins, and then Gunter and Randall are the second string quarterbacks, but they were so bad last year.
And this is again my pet peeve, that the Packers played 10% of their defense in base. Why does the depth chart still list the base defense? You should put nickel as a position on there and slot receiver.
I'm so concerned about Alexa jumping in to talk about base defense. Right. Looking over there at us. But so you're saying that receivers should be able to find separation if Russell Wilson has time.
I think that's the key. Yeah. Does Russell Wilson have time? Yeah. And does he not throw, what was it, 5 interceptions?
Yes, 5.
I'm taking the under on that one this year. I mean, that game just that was such a bad game.
What percent of, so the last two times the Seahawks played in Green Bay, they scored 17 points and 10 points against not very good defenses. Do you think it just happens to be against Green Bay that the offense struggled twice, or is there something about Green Bay's defense that actually gives the Seahawks problems?
I mean, it's to go back to that 2014 opener, certainly it wasn't the case then, but even in that 2014 NFC Championship game, Seahawks offense really was sluggish for a long period of time until, you know, basically running in hurry up the entirety of the fourth quarter and a ton of read option and Russell Wilson keeping the ball, which is kind of like the break glass in case of emergency Seahawks offense, I would say. Like, until they did that, they couldn't get anything going in that game. So that, I think that was midseason that year where they moved around Clay Matthews. Maybe it was Clay Matthews, an inside linebacker, that was the problem. And now that he's back outside, we'll be fine.
Yes. Don't have to worry about Clay Matthews as much. It is strange, though, that we should have looked this up, that the Seahawks seem to play much worse offensively against Green Bay, despite the fact that Green Bay doesn't traditionally have a good defense.
Yeah, I feel like Green Bay and Dallas are the two sneaky bad defense teams that the Seahawks just always can't do anything on offense against, and it's really frustrating.
That sounds about right.
So I'm saying that we go into this feeling like the Seahawks should be able to move the ball, but actually...
No, they probably don't.
If we've learned anything from playing the Packers numerous times over the last 5 years, it'll probably be a very tough game for the Seahawks to move the ball.
How important a game is this? Because Green Bay and Seattle do go into the season as probably the two favorites for the number one seed in the NFC, despite the fact that Atlanta won the conference last year and had a better record than either of them.
I think the answer depends on how good you think Arizona will be. So if you don't think Arizona will be very good, then those games aren't as important, and this game might be the most important game of the season. But if the division is going to be contested, then it's probably one of the Arizona games.
That's a good point.
Man, it's I just hate to play this game in week one, because it's obviously an important game. At the same time, week one means so little as you get farther into the season. But a game against a team that could decide whatever seeding the Seahawks get in the playoffs could be a very huge deal. I mean, it might mean that we're looking back on in week 17 when the season is over, we're looking back and the Seahawks are the 3 seed because they lost this game in the first week of the season. And I think that would be a very frustrating thing for us. So I'm going to say I think it is a very important game. Despite the fact that it's week one, I think it's a very important game.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question it's very important. I mean, it's just like a level of, is it very, very important or just very important?
I think it's very, very important.
All right, so that said, chances of winning, And let's start with you.
So the point spread is 3 points, which is about implies about a 60% chance of Green Bay winning. So I guess that's like the rational. So that's what the head feels. So what the heart feels is this is the eighth season that Pete Carroll has coached the Seahawks in. So they've played seven seasons. In those seven seasons, the first road game they played, they won one time.
Which was Carolina.
That was Carolina. So I'm going to say, and because of all the previous struggles against Green Bay, the last time they won in Lambeau was, I think, when they were in the AFC. So I'm going to go with a 1-in-7 chance. Or 14%.
Wow.
14%. They really haven't won in Green Bay since they were in the AFC. Man, I stopped
think
watching.
I thought it was 1999.
I stopped watching that playoff game when Matt Hasselbeck said, "We want the ball and we're going to score," right after he said that. So don't tell me what happened. I was going to say 30%, and now I feel like I'm wildly overrating the Seahawks' chances here.
Yeah, I started out at 35%. I mean, one factor is, like, look, if you are going to play at Lambeau Field, you'd rather do it in September than you would in November, as they have much of the time in the past.
Yes. So and something. It felt like, I don't know if this is a common trend with Green Bay, but it seemed like last year they started out poorly, right? They went into Jacksonville. Barely beat the Jaguars, and then went to Minnesota and lost to Minnesota, and then came back and barely beat Detroit the following week. And they went through some struggles early season, especially the four-game losing streak right in the middle of the season. It could be that Green Bay takes a little bit longer to figure things out, especially because this is kind of a piecemeal defense for them. They have a lot of new pieces in there, and they don't have, aside from Clay Matthews, any obvious linchpin to the defense. In the same way that the Seahawks are bringing back almost everyone, plus adding Sheldon Richardson, who I have to say looks pretty excited to be a Seahawk, and are coming in there with a pass rush that, I mean, they're going to have to find a replacement for TJ Lang, and the Seahawks have a pass rush who is ready to tee off against somebody. I mean, this is still the team that I believe they sacked Aaron Rodgers 7 times in the first half, the first time that Russell Wilson faced the Packers, and I think there's a chance, granted it's in Green Bay, it'll be difficult. I think there's a chance they can get after Rodgers enough to make them uncomfortable enough to make this a close game.
We haven't mentioned this, but their right tackle, Brian Bulaga, has been struggling with an ankle injury, and it sounds like it's not guaranteed that he'll even play. So if he's out, then maybe I'd bump it up to 15%.
Brian Bulaga's worth 1%.
It's good to hear some optimism there. I'm going to go with 35%. You know, closer in line with the numbers here on this one.
I'm sticking with 30.
One other thing to watch we haven't talked about, Green Bay's kickoff coverage has been atrocious the last couple of years, like in the bottom six in the NFL. So it sounds like it's going to be Tyler Lockett back out there returning kicks next week. I mean, that's what Pete Carroll said, is if he's back, he's back all the way. So keep an eye on that. That's all I have to say on that. Keep an eye.
That sounds ominous. It's like you know the future.
Well, it was ominous in a positive way, though. Not like... Keep an eye, like, I think he's going to get injured, knock on.
Positive, ominous.
All right. Well,
the ominous part is Carroll said Lockett will return kicks if he plays.
Right. I mean, I think he's, so, you know, he's generally trended towards him playing. I feel pretty comfortable with that one.
And do we feel confident about everybody playing? Is there anybody that we're concerned with health-wise?
I mean, it sounds like the running backs are ready to go, so not really.
I think Rawls might be questionable, but Procise is ready.
That's a classic C3 Procise durability.
Yeah. What do we expect? What is the percentage distribution of carries between the running backs?
That's so hard. is Lacy the starter? I don't even know who the running back one is.
It's tough. I think if Rawls is healthy, that Rawls seems to be running back one, but
yeah,
it's really hard to tell.
And I don't think it really matters that much. Yes, by the way, Carroll says expects Tyler Lockett back this week and says I'll return kicks and punts if back. So, expects.
Do you expect Chris Carson to get a carry in this game?
Yes.
Yeah, I'll definitely take that bet.
You'll take over 0.5 carries for Chris Carson?
I will.
It's a crowded backfield. Do you expect Eddie Lacy to score a touchdown and point to the Green Bay bench? Look, we're used to some NFC North revenge games happening. Is this the Eddie Lacy Green Bay revenge game?
I hope so. Maybe he can do the title belt celebration like John Ryan did in the NFC Championship game. And
yes.
Yes.
So here for that. All right. Well, on that note, I think we should wrap it up by saying thanks to Ben for joining us. This has been long awaited, and I hope all the it lived up to all the excitement and anticipation.
Thanks for having me. I honestly have been looking forward to this all weekend. So it's a pleasure, and great talking football and other things with you guys.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks.
Thank you.